hear that you were well treated last week, that Dr. Mook did a really good ministry. I also heard it was a real hive of activity. Beehive, okay. Well,
nobody wants, even at, 5 minutes late, I mean, for ending. People were just sitting here and nobody wanted to leave.
That's great.
The whole class was quite engaged, I believe.
That's great. Well, we're back into Revelation today. We're, as you remember, we're looking at the four great visions that John has given in the Revelation. And we're in the second one, and we've come to the second part of the second one, which is dealing with the warnings of wrath and the seven trumpets. On the back of your handout is a close-up of that section. You see at the top it says the warnings of wrath and the seven trumpets. And that part itself breaks up into two parts. John first saw, over on the left, heavenly fire cast down, beginning of chapter 8. And then in chapter 8, verse 6, the seven trumpets are begun to be blown. So today we'll be looking at the rest of chapter 8, where the first, second, third, and fourth trumpets. So now go back to the front page of your handout, and let's read together, firstly, verse 7 through 13. The first sounded, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood, and they were thrown to the earth, and a third of the earth was burned up, and a third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass was burned up. The second angel sounded, and something like a great mountain burning with fire was thrown into the sea. And a third of the sea became blood, and a third of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died, and a third of the ships were destroyed. The third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch. And it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of waters. The name of the star is called Wormwood. And a third of the waters became wormwood. And many men died from the waters because they were made bitter. The fourth angel sounded, and a third of the sun and a third of the moon and a third of the stars were struck, so that a third of them would be darkened, and the day would not shine for a third of it, and the night in the same way. Then I looked, and I heard an eagle flying in mid-heaven, saying with a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth, because of the remaining blasts of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound." So we've read the first four trumpets last, and before we go into these one by one, I have a little section of introduction to compare these judgments with the seven seal judgments that we've studied previously, that you can make some comparisons and some contrasts. Comparison with them, something they have in common, is that the first four of the seven seals, remember that? There's the book, and the Lamb pops the seal, and John sees a scene, and pops another seal and another seal. Well, seven seals, four of them were all alike. What were the first four seals about? What was the thing that was envisioned? Yeah, there's four horsemen. So the first four of the seven seals were very similar. They all dealt with horsemen. And then seals 5 and 6 and 7 had different kinds of images. Well, we have something similar here with the seven trumpet blasts. Not because there's horsemen, but the first four are similar. And the next three are somewhat different. The first four of the seven trumpet judgments are similar, all dealing with one-thirds. How do you do that? I guess that's one way. That's the cheating way. One-thirds. Remember that? Every one of the trumpet blasts, and a third of the earth is burned. The next one, a third of the sea is contaminated. And a third of the fresh waters. And finally, in trumpet blast 4, a third of the light is taken out. But then when you get to blast 5, it's totally different. It's not similar anymore. So that's an interesting comparison between these the seal judgments and the trumpet judgments. But there's also some contrast. I don't think that these trumpet blasts are just sort of saying the same thing again. There is a view that says John sees seven scenes of judgment with the seals, and then the trumpets blow, and it basically it's the same thing again. You know, but there are some noticeable differences. While the kinds of judgments that are foreshown with the seven seals is similar to those of the seven trumpets, they are not identical. In the seven seals, there is destruction that is specifically said to be one-fourth of the earth, but repeatedly here in the seven trumpets, it's one-third, which is more. If you know your math, you know, a third, I know three is less than four, but one-third is more than one-fourth. So there's an increase in the kind of judgment that's being discussed. Well, depending on how it's stacked up, it could be one-third of the remaining three-quarters, which would be less than 50%, but...
No, when you add the two up, it's 50%. Okay, 100 minus 25 is 75.
I know,
one-third of 75 is 25. It is actually the same proportion. And so it means 50% of the world dies on the earth during the Great Tribulation.
Well, I certainly agree there's a massive amount of death, but it depends on, is it, if you kill off 25%, now you have 75%, one-third of 75% is not quite 50. It depends on how you...
25 plus 25 is 50%.
No, it's... 25%, and then you kill off 33% of that is not quite 100. Is not quite 50%. It's about 40 something. It's okay. A lot of people die. I mean, all right. So let's take a look at the first trumpet blast in verse 7. The first sounded, and there came hail and fire mixed with blood. And they were thrown to the earth, and a third of the earth was burned up, a third of the trees were burned up, and all the green grass burned up. After the trumpet is blown, John sees this devastating hail and fire on the earth. The fire, you have to conjecture of what did this look like. Is he describing the effect along with the event? That is, is the fire the result of... all of the of lightning? Is the blood the result of all these things coming down? Or is this a vision describing these are the things which are going to take place on the earth? The end result is, though, a third of the earth's vegetation is destroyed. This vision, remember these are visions and not videos. So I don't know that this verse requires us to think that there's going to be a ball of something traveling through space into earth. The idea is that these things are going to appear on the earth and that the ultimate cause of them is heaven. So it doesn't require celestial transport from heaven, just like the prophecy of the seven horsemen isn't really about horses roaming around the earth. The scene, go to letter D on the next page, the scene of judgment is similar to the seventh plague. The seventh plague on Egypt. I mentioned this a couple weeks ago, that the judgments of the trumpets and the seals and even the bowls to come mirror, in some ways, the ten plagues of Egypt. They're not in order. It's not like they go 1, 2, 3, 4 through 10 that way. But the seventh plague of Egypt in Exodus 9, verse 24... So there was hail and fire flashing continually in the midst of the hail, very severe, such as had not been in all the land of Egypt since it became a nation. The hail struck all that was in the field through all the land of Egypt, both man and beast. The hail also struck every plant of the field and shattered every tree of the field. Only the land of Goshen, where the sons of Israel were, there was no hail. You notice that the destruction of the plant life, the thing that John sees in addition is blood. Which suggests the death of people along with all of this destruction. We come to verse 8, back to verse 8 in Revelation 8, the second trumpet, death in the sea. And when John describes this, he struggles with words. This is, if you will, this is inspired struggling with words. The Spirit inspires him to write it this way, but John doesn't have an adequate vocabulary to describe what he sees. He says, I saw something like a great mountain burning with fire that was thrown into the sea. So there have been different theories as to what this is. I didn't put this in the notes, but one view is that this is a description of a meteor that has come and makes a strike on the sea. Another popular view is that this is a reference to volcanic activity. Volcanoes are something like mountains. They are mountains, but they're more than mountains. Mount Vesuvius had erupted just about 20 years earlier, and the effects were known all around the Roman Empire. Many Jewish writers interpreted it as a sign of judgment on Rome. And there was a Roman statesman who went to Vesuvius to try to rescue his family, and he ended up, Pliny the Elder, he ended up getting caught and died. And then his nephew, Pliny the Younger, came, and he was there. He witnessed some of the after effects. He said the whole sea withdrew, and you could see all of the sea life floundering on the sand, dying. And then, you know, sort of the tidal wave came back in later on. But as bad as Vesuvius was, whatever phenomenon this describes is far, far worse, because it's not just a localized area. It is a third of loss of life, of sea life. A third loss of the world's maritime fleet. And a turning of a third of the water, the salt water, into blood. Now, which of the plagues of Egypt does that remind you of? The first plague that Moses, God brings on Egypt, is the turning of the Nile. Actually, that's fresh water, but it is similar. They have water being turned to blood. The blood could simply be the effect of all of the dead sea life. Not so much an alchemy of turning water to blood, per se, but it is devastating. I mean, the effects of doing this to the earth are, I mean, we are so dependent on the sea, much more than we realize. This is a major collapse of our ecosystem. The third judgment, verses 10 through 11, death in the fresh waters. Verse 10, the third angel sounded, and a great star fell from heaven, burning like a torch, and it fell on a third of the rivers and on the springs of waters. The name of the star is called Wormwood, and a third of the waters became wormwood. And many men died from the waters because they were made bitter. So here we have some kind of celestial body. He calls it a great star. That in Greek, the word star is used for comets and meteors and what we call stars as well. So it could be anything like that. Some kind of celestial body falls to the earth. And that's one reason I think that the second trumpet is something more like a volcano than this, because this is clearly something extraterrestrial that comes to the earth. It causes cataclysmic disruption of a third of the first earth's freshwater sources. And John is told that the name is Wormwood. I don't think this means that everyone is going to say, the great Wormwood star, because it's not going to be the broadcast, the headline. He is being told that's the name, what the name of this star is. Wormwood. Most of us don't have any idea what Wormwood is. If you've read C.S. Lewis, you know that's the name of one of the demons in his stories. But Wormwood is a fairly common plant. It grows in the eastern Mediterranean. Israel has about three different varieties of Wormwood. It's not technically a poison, but it is an extremely bitter plant. This is the kind of plant that's spoken about in Hebrews, where he says, "See to it that no root of bitterness sprouts up among you." You know, this wormwood is—he's quoting from Deuteronomy, where, if I remember correctly, the term for wormwood is used. Wormwood is a bitter plant, grows in the desert regions. It's not a poison, but it is extremely bitter. And sometimes people would mix wormwood with poison wood was used positively in ancient days, even today in Arabia and Israel and places like this. It's eaten, the leaves are eaten by camels and goats. Of course, the breath it gives them is not so great. And the Bedouins will take the leaves and chop them and dry them and make this really super strong tea that no one really wants to have. No one wants to have. It's been used as a cure-all for a long, long time. And it really doesn't cure all that much, but it was thought to be a cure, for instance, for intestinal worms. And that's where the name wormwood comes from. So they had positive uses. But whenever it's mentioned in the Bible, it's used negatively. It's always used negatively in the Bible as a bad thing. And it's almost always used in the Bible figuratively. The gall of bitterness, phrases like this. It's never speaking about the actual plant. It's always referring to bitterness, which is associated with that particular plant. So the prophecy doesn't require that there be particles of the wormwood plant floating around, and it's not that this meteor or whatever it is has wormwood particles in it. It's the effect that's focused on, that the fresh waters become bitter and to the point that they're not potable. People are dying for lack of fresh water. This is also similar to the first plague of Egypt, because you've got the water being stricken, although not with blood this time. Okay, now we come to verse 12 and the fourth trumpet. The fourth angel sounded, and a third of the sun, and a third of the moon, and a third of the stars were struck, so that a third of them would be darkened, and a day would not shine for a third of it, and the night in the same way. This is the dimming of the heavenly lights. All of this is really, really ominous. Somehow, and it's not explained how, but somehow, all of the heavenly sources of light are partially dimmed, resulting in a partial loss of light through both the day and the night. Now, if this is to be understood in a completely literal way, that the sun itself is literally reduced in its power, then this is a miraculous judgment that represents the beginning of the undoing of time. When you go back to the very beginning of the Bible, the reason we're told that God creates the sun, the moon, and the stars in Genesis 1, verse 14. Let's flip back to that. Genesis 1, verse 14. Then God said, "Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, and let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and years, and let them be for lights in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth." And it was so. God made the two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He made the stars also. God placed them in the expanse of the heavens to give light on the earth and to govern the day and the night and to separate the light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. Yes, question?
Yeah, it's interesting, that word light, because back in verse 3, God said that there be light, and the sun wasn't shining yet.
It's actually two different Hebrew words. The word for light earlier, when he says let there be light, refers to light in general, whereas the word for let there be lights means light sources. It's actually a separate Hebrew word.
You think it's two different things? Because light can be like a revelation to us.
Oh, I see.
Spiritual light.
Well, I think because in this passage the context is the physical creation. That it's there was light. Originally the creation is unformed and unfilled in its darkness.
Okay.
So then God's bringing.
He was just saying what he was about to do. Is that it?
I think the earth is shrouded in light without natural sources originally. And then God sets in motion. Now, from now on, once he creates the sun, the moon, and the stars, these things are going to govern the day and the night, as opposed to the previous days, God himself was governing the creation with his own light. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is striking that there are separate Hebrew words that are used. So the really striking thing here is that the purpose of the luminaries is to reckon time. We keep time by the sun, the moon, and the stars. Day to day, month to month, the seasons, and you can plot how the stars are. I just got one of these apps on my phone that you hold it up to the sky and it tells you what star you're looking at. It's pretty, and the weird thing is if you point it down, and it'll tell you what they're seeing in China. We're from the other side of the world. Well, what happens when those things stop working? What does that imply? It implies that time, as we know it, is coming to an end.
I was just thinking how that would affect our, would it affect our weather or our growth of things, you know, the sun, you know, and all the, you I know the moon has to do with the tides and all that, you know, how does that affect all of that?
You'd have to assume what. Now, I'm going to go on in a moment, I'm going to share another view that will say the fulfillment of these things, they describe phenomena that appear, but they are not actual. The sun isn't actually dimming the moon, it's what appears upon the earth, but if it is actually happening this way, that the sun itself dims by 33%, then yeah, unless God creates a new order of laws of science, yeah, we're looking at massive disruption on the whole ecosystem. But I should mention another view that this can be understood, and here is your $100 word for the day. This is not just a $50 word. This is a $100 word. And I specifically put the blank here so that you could bleed it over under the rest of the page. Okay. And let me see how many syllables. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 syllables. 8 syllables. Phenomena. Logically.
Wow.
Phenomenologically. Okay. Hey, it worked. Didn't spill. That was a phenomenon. So what word do you see in there that you recognize?
Phenomenon.
Phenomenon. And then logical. And then the lee. Yeah, the lee. Okay, this is a word that describes things that, in other words, things are described as they appear, not necessarily what they are. Does that make sense? Things are described in the way that they appear, but not in the way that they are. So we talk about sunrise and sunset. Because from the perspective of the earth, it appears that the sun is rising and the sun is setting. But from a cosmological perspective, we know that what's actually happening is the earth is, you know, spinning and rotating around the sun. So the Bible uses phenomenological language all the time. We use it all the time, too, and don't even think about it. Sunrise, sunset are the two most common ones. So it's possible that the language here about what's happening is phenomenological, that from the perspective of Earth, from a common person, not with a telescope, but just a common person enduring the tribulation, it appears as if the light of the sun and the moon and the stars is a third darkened, is a third diminished. And the cause of that could be any number of things. We've got all of these things that have been invading the Earth and erupting in the Earth, and the amount of ash and particulate that's floating around the atmosphere could dramatically dim the appearance of these lights.
This is, again, here we have the problems with Revelation, yeah, and the time, trying to figure out a time for the setup, for the events, you know, it's really, really tough. But this darkening of the sun, I believe it's spoken of in more than one place in Revelation.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and elsewhere in the prophets also, the sun will be dark and the moon shall not give its light, and the great day of the Lord comes upon. Yes, that's right. Joel, Jesus quotes it too in terms of Revelation.
And when you know, you can mess with the earth, you know, and you can go burn the forest down, and you know, you can do lots of stuff like that, but you can't, as a human, you
that's
can't
right.
reach out and touch the sun. And
that's right.
So, I mean, this is a massive miracle or intervention or whatever.
Yeah.
But the immediate effect in Revelation is to help the Jews in some way. You know, it's that particular time, it's combined with the Mount of Olives splitting in half, and the Jews, those who are in Jerusalem, some of them escape. When the Mount of Olives splits in half, it creates another valley, as it were. So when you come out of Jerusalem and you cross the brook Kidron and you're headed toward the Mount of Olives, you find yourself in another valley, which takes you on away from that particular scene. At least that's how I've read it, I mean, so many times. So that earthquake and the valley, Mount of Olives splitting, and even the darkening of the sky is all beneficial to those people who the Lord wants to protect that are in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And now they go somewhere, and a lot of people think it's
Petra.
Thank you. Anyway, so is that part of the answer?
This is a good question. The series of seven judgments, when exactly do these happen? Do they occur in exactly this sequence? Are they interspersed with each other? John does not give us a timeline. He doesn't tell us, and in the fifth year, in the third month, this will happen, and then the second month, this happened. We don't know. They are told in a sequential order, but we don't know if they're going to be exactly chronological. It would seem like there's some kind of chronology, but it's hard. I don't think you can reconstruct a chronology until you get into the later part of the vision, where he starts to give days. So many days will happen, and then so many years will happen.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of plotting these particular events, I don't think we can. It's possible that some of them are telescoping out to the end. And, you know, there might be sort of a seesawing back and forth, and things at the very end and things leading up to the end.
Yes.
Yeah. That's one of the challenges. And you know, it's those kind of challenges that make some people give up. Because they want all the answers, and you can't get all the answers without becoming really, really speculative. Now, one reason I think we ought to give some time to the idea that the darkening is phenomenological is later on in John's visions, the sun is at more than full strength. You know, in chapter 16, verses 8 to 9, the sun is burning so brightly that it's killing people. So if it is a cosmological dimming of the sun as opposed to a phenomenological one, then it has to be temporary. So it's hard to be dogmatic, but it may be that the darkening is the effect of the pervasive smoke and particulate that's floating in the atmosphere due to all the other judgments. But that letter D, the prophets often describe the day of the Lord as a time of great darkness on the earth. Let's flip back to a couple of these passages together. Ezekiel chapter 32. That's right after, if you find Isaiah, then go past Jeremiah and Ezekiel after that. Chapter 32, verses 7 to 8. And when I extinguish you, I will cover the heavens and darken their stars. I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon will not give its light. All the shining lights in the heavens I will darken over you, and will set darkness on your land. Now this is specifically spoken against Egypt. The prophecies in Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel often have both immediate relevancy. They're going after the enemies of Israel at that time, but
included in those prophecies are sometimes long-range perspectives of things when the battles with Israel's enemies are finally done. Here, the darkness is limited to the land of Egypt. You notice that? What does that remind you of? The ninth plague. You know, it's as if God is going to do it again to Egypt. So this may not be exactly the same thing that we're seeing in Revelation, but it's similar to it.
Well, it says he's going to cover the sun with a cloud. And he doesn't necessarily say that the sun is going to be darkened.
That's right. And there's no reference to the third portion of it. Flip forward to Joel. Look at Joel. If you get to Jonah, you're too far. Joel chapter 2 and verse 10. Before them the earth quakes, the heavens tremble, the sun and the moon grow dark, and the stars lose their brightness. The Lord utters his voice before his army. Surely his camp is very great, for strong is he who carries out his word. The day of the Lord is indeed great and very awesome, and who can endure it? This is describing an invasion of Israel. The Lord is bringing an army against them. Go back, by the way, to verse 2 of chapter 2. Actually, verse 1 even. Blow a trumpet in Zion, and sound an alarm on my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of the Lord is coming. Surely it is near, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and thick darkness, as the dawn is spread over the mountains. So there is a great and mighty people. There has never been anything like it, nor will there be anything again after it, the years of many generations. Flip forward to chapter 3 of Joel, verse 15. Actually, I want us to back up to verse 9 and get a sense of the context. This part of Joel's prophecy, everyone agrees, is about the end of the age. Earlier in the book, he has prophecies about the Assyrians coming into the land, and some of those foreshadow the end, but this is about the end of the age. Verse 9, proclaim this among the nations, prepare a war, rouse the mighty men. Let all the soldiers draw near. Let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears. Let the weak say, I am a mighty man. Hasten and come, all you surrounding nations, and gather yourselves there. Bring down, O Lord, your mighty ones. Let the nations be aroused and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat. For there I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, tread, for the winepress is full. The vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and moon grow dark, and the stars lose their brightness. The Lord roars from Zion and utters his voice from Jerusalem, and the heavens and the earth tremble. For the Lord is a refuge for his people and a stronghold for the sons of Israel. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy mountain. So Jerusalem will be holy, and strangers will pass through it no more. What is the Valley of Jehoshaphat? What's the Valley of Jehoshaphat? That's another name for the Valley of Megiddo. Yeah, and this is not in your notes, but Revelation will talk about Armageddon. The R part is a Hebrew word for mountain. It means the mountain of Megiddo. At the mountain, there's right below it, is the valley of Megiddo. So that's also referred to as the valley of Jehoshaphat. So Joel, talking about the darkening of the skies, sees it as Armageddon. So again, it's not exactly the same. It doesn't mention, or I should say, it's not as detailed. It doesn't say a third. But it is like it It does fit at least in the same range of things. Jesus quotes this passage in Matthew chapter 24. In this part of the Gospels, this is the last great public sermon that Jesus gives. It's often called the Little Apocalypse because it's a vision of the end of the age. In many ways, the book of Revelation is an expansion of Jesus' last sermon. In Matthew 24, verse 29, "But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other." So, and we come back to Revelation 8. Is this describing Armageddon? Or is it something before Armageddon, and in which case Armageddon is even worse? It's hard to be, again, it's very difficult to create a chronology of events with these things, but you see the similarities with things that have been said before in the prophets. And as was mentioned before, this judgment is somewhat like which plague that came on Egypt?
The ninth.
It's like the ninth plague in which there was great darkness over the land of Egypt. So we come to verse 13, and this is the transition to the next one. Before we come to trumpets 5, 6, and 7, verse 13 says, "Then I looked, and I heard an eagle flying in mid-heaven, saying with a loud voice, 'Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth, because of the remaining blasts of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound.'" So before any more angels sound off, John sees an eagle flying and talking. I mean, this is unusual. Above the atmosphere. Now it says mid-heaven. And it seems like what this means is it's not in the highest heaven where the throne of God is, but it's something lower. Either it means it's in the atmosphere like a bird would normally, or it could even mean it's in the celestial space, flying, you know, in what we call outer space. Hard to be certain. He's announcing that greater woes are coming. And again, I think this is a vision and not a video. I don't think anyone is going to hear a sound from heaven at this time. This eagle may very well be one of the cherubs that was described earlier as looking like an eagle. And there are later verses where we're told angels fly through mid-heaven giving pronouncements. Back in chapter 4, verse 7, "The first creature was like a lion, the second creature like a calf, the third creature had the face of a man, and the fourth creature was like a flying eagle." The fourth of the cherubim is described as an eagle. That may be what John sees here. Three more trumpet blasts are going to be blown, so the eagle utters this threefold woe for those who are mere earth dwellers. When he says the inhabitants of the earth, that the phrase, those who dwell on the earth, it's addressed towards people who are earthbound. There is an elect, there is a remnant of people on the earth who the Lord is saving and will bring through this time of tribulation. But these, most of them, are just earthbound. They are not heavenly-minded people. They're earthly-minded people. They're just mere earth dwellers. And so when we come back next time in chapter 9, three more blasts, and the effects are worse than what we've seen before. Well, now is the chance for you to ask all the questions that you have, and so that I can say we don't have time. Yes, Jim?
Why is there so much debate on the term reckoning and reckoning? There wasn't too much
Oh, they have the same thing with Joshua. Yeah, the same thing. You know, is it a miracle? Is it a celestial miracle in Joshua, or is it a phenomenological miracle? Where it's a miracle one way or the other, but is it a miracle in which God? It's a miracle of refraction, where the sun's lights are refracted, so it appears that it stands still. So you have the same issue there.
Yeah, but it had to do with his arms raised or not. So, fluctuating.
Yeah. Oh, you're thinking of Aaron and Hur. No, the sun stands still on its that stays still until they complete the battle. Yeah, you have that same issue. Is that how much of it is phenomenological? It's still a miracle, no doubt about that. So I don't take the view that it was just, you know, really weird weather that day in Joshua 2.
I've always understood Revelation. I mean, the death rate or the deaths in Revelation of humans to be a much higher number, you know, than just the third and all of that. I mean, and probably Revelation is such a complicated book, you know. And even though I've read it several times, probably need to read it many more times and apply many other spots, the minor prophets and all these things, Joel, and all these things are so important, Zechariah, to really try to get it right. But all of this stuff has happened, and a lot of people have died through here, you know, the third, the fourth, the result, the seventh, I mean, all through there. And then after this wiping out of a third of the human race, then an angel comes along and says, "Whoa, whoa, whoa!" You know.
Yeah.
What could be more? I mean,
it is staggering. It is. And I just realized that your math is correct. Yeah. So let's say the world, there's 100 people in the world, and which is very small, of course, and we. A quarter of that, now we're down to 75, and then we take one third of that, now we are down to 50. Yes, you were vindicated.
And then the freaky thing is what's next is people are going to want to die and not be able to die.
That's right. Yeah.
And it's like, whoa!
Yeah. Whoa. Different kind of whoa. You got a question?
You know, you mentioned Tetras.
Is Petra. That, Petra. Petra.
Okay. Is it, and I've heard other people, friends, mention that it's a safe place or something like that in these end times, or is that towards the Battle of Armageddon?
Yeah, it's something.
Strays away from what we're talking
Petra,
about.
In ancient days, Petra was always regarded as an impenetrable fortress. If you've seen Indiana Jones, you've seen Petra. You know, he comes, there's that weird fortress carved out of rock. That's part of it. So, there's some prophecies.
What does the Bible say about that?
It says that the Jews will flee to Salah, which is another name for that region.
Uh-huh.
And so, it's kind of a no man's land still today. If it weren't for tourism, there wouldn't be anyone there but veterans.
And it doesn't offer any safety for any of this?
Not during the whole course of it, no, but it seems like toward the end, there's an escape of people.
You're mentioning how it's kind of winding down time.
Yeah.
It seems like time is like a vapor compared to the infinite amount of God's being. He created time
for
such a short time. What's he been up to before and after?
Yeah.
You know.
Time is for our benefit, not God's. He doesn't need time. He exists outside of time. Yes.
If you interpret when it talks about time shall be no more, you know, and all that can mean different things. But if you're in a physical world,
there has to be some time.
And you do away with time. Then you just freeze all motion. Nothing,
because
after
time
that,
and space are interconnected.
After that, nothing can move anymore.
Yeah.
And it doesn't seem likely because, you know, when we are going to be on an earth, and it's going to be
new heaven and a new earth.
Anyway,
but no sun.
We're way
so
over.
So time, if whatever time as we know it, will be no more for sure. Maybe there's a new sense of time revolving around God Himself, in which we physically, in the resurrected bodies, live with Him forever.
You know, you stop to think about it, and let's say Adam, from that, say, went to cortical hell, I believe, fire. And then Job, low at the end of Revelation, is the last one, he goes to the lake of fire. Well, that's not fair. Look at all that time Adam's been there. But see, once you're out of the time realm,
right. Yeah. Hell is not populated. It's not governed by time. That's right. Yeah. Well, we need to stop before 7 years have elapsed. Let's have prayer. Lord, we're thankful for that time we've had this morning and the good discussion and to form our minds in thinking that you are a God who is in control and will bring things to its appointed end. And in the meantime, Lord, do your appointed work in us. May we be responsive and obedient to your will and way in making known the news that there is a Savior who is coming back. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.